Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. There's a lot of other places that I don't even know about, but you probably do. And any place that you want to listen to us is really okay. What a surprise that the National Security Council is back in the news, whether or not you want to talk about the deep state or what's going on with John Bolton and the stresses and the strains between him and other members of the administration. There is a must-read book about this, basically how the National Security Council transformed the American way of life, which is the subhead of White House Warriors, by John Gans of the University of Pennsylvania, who joins us in the Bulwark Podcast. Thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
No, you actually mentioned that when you first came up with the idea of writing a book about the NSC, people were going, why? Why would you want to write about that?
So you're a
former speechwriter for the Pentagon, right?
I am. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Why the NSC?
Well, so it started in part as a dissertation. You know, mm-hmm. I was looking for a question, and I was walking around Washington one day and walked by the old executive office building, which is where they sit, and I ran into a friend who was working on the NSC. And I walked up to see my dissertation advisor, Elliot Cohen, who's an eminent civil military historian. And I said, what about the NSC? And he said, well, there's been dozens of books written about the NSC. It's been well covered. And he said, go read them and then tell me. And I went and read them. And I said, there actually hasn't been dozens of books written on the NSC. And he said, really? Well, then go ahead. And so I started this as a process before I went into government. After I finished the dissertation, I went in and served as chief speechwriter to Ash Carter. And was scolded occasionally by the NSC and saved occasionally by the NSC staffers who call over and tell you.
So you're wondering, who are these guys?
Exactly.
How do they get there? How do they get so much power?
Exactly. What do they do with their days? Because I think the thing is that they look awfully busy. They run up in the morning those steps at the old executive office building and they come down late at night. And I thought, this is a story that hasn't been told. And this is a story I think people like my parents and others around America both deserve to know and need to know, because they explain where we are in the world.
I thought it was interesting. You have a blurb from Dr. Kurt Campbell, who's a former Obama Assistant Secretary of State for Asia and the Pacific. And he describes the NSC as part star chamber, part gladiator arena, and part Game of Thrones drama.
Exactly.
And he says in your book, expertly revealed to us in the pages of this book. So you start off, you go back into the history of all of this, the idea that you would have this kind of unaccountable organization, not subject to Senate confirmation, not part of the State Department, not part of the Defense Department. And you wrote a piece for The Atlantic where you start off with Oliver North.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of people, that was the first time that the NSC was front and center.
Absolutely. It was for me. I remember watching those hearings as a kid. And I think...
By the way, you confessed that he was 8 years old.
8 years old.
On a family vacation, sitting in a motel room watching the Senate hearings with Oliver North.
I think it was raining, and I think I would have much rather been at the beach or wherever we were in Florida, and instead we were stuck inside watching Iran-Contra affair. And, you know, it's the little things that change your life. And here I am sitting here talking about the NSC today. But what's funny about it is what I talk about is there's, and especially in the Atlantic pieces, there is this issue of unaccountable power, and to a degree empowering the president and those that claim to speak for the president, as Oliver North did. And there's been this push and pull in Washington. And to a degree, the NSC started as an effort to get power away from the presidency, right? And Franklin Roosevelt scared the hell out of the military and the rest of Washington because he basically tried to run World War II alone. He called it his juggling. Like, he lied to people. Yeah. He did those things. And Washington basically said, we got to do better than this, with a sick president, a two-front war, and a nuclear weapons in the offing. And when they had the chance after the war and after Roosevelt had passed away, they created a National Security Council in order to bring those conversations into a more collaborative conversation between the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Secretary, and other cabinet-level secretaries. But unfortunately, in one line of law, they created an NSC staff. And they said, these are the people that are going to help all these big names show up on time, know what they're talking about, and then record what they decide. Unfortunately, the president after president have basically said, we need these people to work for me. And they've empowered the staff time and time and time again. And you saw that manifestation and the misuse of that power in Oliver North. And despite a lot of calls to bring him back in and bring the staff back into control, they actually empowered it again. And you've seen it grow in power and size and strength since, especially after the wars that start after 9/11. What you now have is a very large, unaccountable powerful body in the middle of government helping make decisions about war and peace.
I want to fast forward to that period, but I want to go back to one anecdote. You're talking about with first President Bush, mm-hmm. after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the story about Richard Haass, who mm-hmm. was a member of the NSC, and he was the NSC aide responsible for basically giving the first President Bush the talking point when he reacting to the invasion of Kuwait. This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait, which was kind of shocking to a lot of people for in sure. the foreign policy military establishment, including, you say, Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was kind of surprised to hear about it that way.
Exactly. So this is this great story, and I'm sure a lot of people remember. It's yeah. one of the few those moments that sort of stick out. And so the war, Iraq invades Kuwait early in August 1990. Yeah. And if you recall, that moment was preceded by George Bush sort of standing in the cabinet room with the National Security Council, and Richard Haass is mm-hmm. sitting on the back bench. And Bush says, you know, we're not talking about an intervention, right? Right. We're not talking about an intervention. Don't worry about that. And everybody sort of says, okay, well, one, mm-hmm. the U.S. isn't that serious about it, and two, Bush is going to let this stand. But that sort of working behind the scenes, Richard Haass, who everybody mm-hmm. now knows from Morning Joe, but was just mm-hmm. even then sort of an anonymous staffer to his own president, because the Middle East wasn't a hot button at the time the Cold War is ending and everything else. And Richard Haass, working with Brent Scowcroft, who was National Security Advisor and an old friend of President Bush, and Bob Gates, mm-hmm. who was the Deputy National Security Advisor at the time, said, we got to do better than this. We can't let that talking point stand. It takes too many options off the table. So they kept working for ways to try and get it in. And Haass was doing a lot of writing, coming up with new ideas and new briefings, and sort of said, we can't let the status quo stand, mm-hmm. right? And eventually, there's this great moment where Richard Haass basically hadn't slept for a week. He was basically up all night working in the Situation Room. And he was sitting in the Situation Room on a Sunday morning in his shorts and T-shirt, was basically needed a change of clothes, and sat here, and he gets a call from Brent Scowcroft. He said, the president's showing up in about a half hour, and we need something new for him to say. And he's going to have to brief the press on the South Lawn where Marine One lands. And Haass basically says, oh, no. Less because he didn't have something new to say, but because he was wearing shorts and a T-shirt. So his first act is to beg a friend for clothes. He borrows a blazer and a tie. And you can see the pictures of him in like this sort of awkward-fitting blazer. And then he starts writing, but he's so tired, he's having a hard time. And Condi Rice says, stand up, I'll write it. Because she was also on the staff at the time. And together they wrote sort of a briefing on what was going on. And Haass actually ended up, he was so tired he needed directions to where he needed to meet the president. When the president landed, he waved mm-hmm. him over. Richard Haass gave him a bit of a sort of a pretty bad briefing. Nothing was working. The sanctions weren't working. Diplomacy wasn't working. And he says, and the president says, well, what should I say? And he says, I think you should say something pretty hard, like say something pretty strong. And Bush just went out and Haass and Bush both claimed the line was his own. And he basically said, this will not stand. And he went back and he said, I have to go to work. And he walked in the mm-hmm. Oval Office and saw Brent Scowcroft and said, where'd you get that line? And Scowcroft and Bush says, well, it was mine. But Colin Powell thought it was Richard Haass's. And he didn't like the idea of cranking up the response, but he also didn't like an SC staffer influencing policy.
Yeah, making policy on the fly, yeah. staking out this tough position. So whoever wrote the line, as you point out, Powell was right to be worried about the power of the National Security Council. Okay, so let's fast forward to where we are right now. Oh, by the way, on Kuwait, this is one of those classic stories, of course, where there was miscalculation. There had been some signals that had been mm-hmm. somewhat ambiguous that were misinterpreted by the Iraqis, who thought that they would be able to walk into Kuwait. Mm-hmm. Another indication of how miscommunication, miscalculations can lead to bad outcomes.
Absolutely.
Which brings us to today mm-hmm. And the National Security Council. Because I know, John Bolton is out there front and center and appears to be very much at variance, at least at the moment, depending on who's leaking to who, whose account you read, at variance with the Secretary of State. So give me your sense of what's actually happening, what the role is of the National Security Council, and whether Bolton might be out over his skis a little bit on Iran.
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing today is something we've seen through history, which is when the National Security Advisor, in this case John Bolton, decides that he's going to sort of break the process in the sense of change what was working, or at least functioning in Washington, which is a pretty running conversation of meetings, deliberations, mm-hmm. consultations to deliver options to a president and assessments to a president, right? Because trying to figure out what's happening, whether it's Iranian missiles in today or on a ship today, or Iraqis putting troops at the border of Kuwait mm-hmm. 30 years ago, what you have to dissemble is between intent and capability, right? You see a new capability, right. But what are they going to do? And they had a hard time with that in Iraq in 1990, and we're having, I think, a hard time about that today. It seems as though John Bolton has basically assumed a lot about intent, and there is more of a debate about that. Unfortunately, because he's sort of minimized the consultations and brought things much tighter into a small circle of his own, sometimes in informal conversations with Secretary mm-hmm. of State and the new secretary, nominated Secretary Shanahan, that puts a premium on his own information and his own assessment, and it puts a premium on those who work for him, which is a very large body of both technical experts, right? There's a mm-hmm. lot of technical experts at the NSC staff and a lot of policy experts, right? So it empowers the White House and puts at a premium what they see.
But all of this comes back to Donald Trump and how Donald Trump makes decisions, how he uses this information or doesn't use this information. Now, you talk to McMaster, right?
I did, yeah.
And talk about, we'll come back to this in a moment. Talk about how Donald Trump saw the NSC. One of the first things that he did was to announce that he was going to put Steve Bannon on the NSC, which was regarded even in the honeymoon phase, to the extent that there was, is pretty shocking. So yeah. what was that about? And tell me about McMaster.
Well, my assessment of it, and from what I've sort of understand in talking to General McMaster and others mm-hmm. from the Trump NSC and around Washington, working in government right now, and some who have recently departed. I mean, what I think we've seen is that Donald Trump was a very, to put it kindly, irregular president, right? He mm-hmm. was somebody that had no governing experience, no military experience at any level, and came into Washington and was basically handed a gigantic interagency process, the process that makes foreign policy, that has basically been working the same way for 30, 40 mm-hmm. years, and it was a bad fit for him. Right. And I think he did things to try and make it fit for him and make it fit for his views. That included okaying Steve Bannon. And my hunch is he didn't understand why that was a big change, because he had no idea that this was a big change, because he didn't know how the process had worked and kind of knew what he wanted it to do. And the town rightly sort of reacted that way. And there was a huge outcry about Bannon being on the PC and some of the other changes that Trump made. But this is this.
Do you know who ultimately kneecapped that, though?
My hunch is that it was H.R. McMaster. Okay. H.R. did a lot to regularize the NSC and try to regularize President Trump. And they tried things to make it work. They helped write his tweets. Yeah. They helped give him briefings that were much more visual, so photos instead of paper, written documents. But I think it was ultimately a bad fit, because Donald Trump's a bad fit for a regular order in Washington. Mm-hmm. And that has frustrated those in government, like the deep state conversation. But it's also frustrated those in government who also have their own opinions about what they want
to do. Okay, so there obviously was not a lot of chemistry between McMaster and Trump.
Yes.
There were reports that he thought he was boring, or he thought he was being lectured to. So how did that relationship break down?
Well, it seems to me that the relationship, I mean, if you sort of read the reporting, especially sort of the Bob Woodward book and things along those lines, it was never a good relationship to begin with. I mean, my hunch is that Donald Trump never wanted to get rid of Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn was his, I think, security blanket in more ways than one. And so for him,
because he was chemically close to the president.
Exactly.
I mean, he was somebody who the president would have listened to because he was a supporter. Yep. They were so close.
Yep.
So
both supporter and I think shared a lot of the similar views. And I think in part because I think Flynn educated the president on the campaign trail and before that. And so, I mean, whereas Trump and Flynn were both sort of what I call arsonists. Yep. They were both people who were willing to change dramatically how things had been going. H.R. McMaster was much more of a strategist, was much more of a person that was like, listen, let's come up with good plans and we'll let the government go do them, right? And his whole deal was, let's try and get the president to agree to a set of plans and then government can do it. Right. And we'll do these plans in a regular fashion. But that's just not, I mean, Trump isn't a strategy guy. I mean, that's just not how he operates. He's much more ad hoc, much more, much more willing to sort of try new things on the fly and see what happens. And that's not what government likes. Very similar to what I talked about with Franklin Roosevelt, right? Roosevelt was a juggler too, right? He tried things and misled people. And to a degree, government doesn't like that. And I think that's where you see this running tension.
So John Bolton is kind of a throwback to the Flynn model of the arsonist.
Yeah. I think he's probably a little bit more of an opportunist in the sense that he's here brought very specific views into government and is using this remarkable opportunity he has to be the national security advisor at a time where the president is focused on a few big issues, not very hands-on. You don't have a secretary of defense who's confirmed.
Right.
And it's a remarkable moment for somebody that has strong foreign policy views, like on Iran, Venezuela.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because clearly John Bolton does have very strong views. He has his own agenda. Mm-hmm. He's been expressing it for a long time. He obviously likes the idea of a regime change in Iran. He's working for a president. He's been close to him, but a president who's kind of a neo-isolationist. And now you have this sort of war of leaks going back and forth. How much power does the NSC, the National Security Advisor, have to pursue their own foreign policy that might be at somewhat variance with the president's? Has there ever been someone who tried to push their own agenda before all of the other the advisors you've looked at?
No, I can't imagine. It's not in my historical interpretation. There's never been anybody who had this strong an opinion about
really?
An agenda.
Okay.
And this, that was so different from the president's, right? In the sense that because Bolton doesn't have a prior relationship with him, nor does he probably, they share in the Venn diagram of beliefs, they share a lot, whether
right.
it's getting rid of some international agreements mm-hmm. and organizations, things along those lines, and protecting American sovereignty.
Yeah.
But from there, it gets pretty dissimilar.
Right.
So I think that this is a very unique moment, and there's a huge amount of daylight between the president and the National Security Advisor. But what I think history does tell us is that when these breakdowns do happen, and listen, these are, and to a degree, that's what Kurt's point about this Game of Thrones. This is like an intense atmosphere. Like, there are days when everybody hates everybody, right? This mm-hmm. is a human interactions, right? There are days when you don't like your boss. I don't like my boss. Mm-hmm. There are days when my boss doesn't like me, right? So there are days when that happens. But what's scary about it is the business of national security doesn't stop when the president and the national security advisor aren't getting along.
And there are nukes out there.
Exactly. There's a lot of bad things out there, right? And so what you find is that in history, when these breakdowns happen up top, the national security staff tends to start filling the gaps. And that is when things tend to go wrong, because as I discuss in the book, the national security staff is very good at knowing when something is going wrong, but they're very bad at knowing what they should do about it.
Why?
In part because they're pretty limited in terms of what they can see. They basically spend their days at the old executive office building and in the White House Situation Room. So you can only see so much, right, on video teleconferences, and only learn so much from emails and phones to the front. The second thing is that they tend to be spending their days servicing the president and dealing with the immediate matters at hand. And they don't always know everything and see the whole field, right? Know what's going on in the military. Know what's going on at our embassies. Know what's going on in these countries. You can assume, because you can read top secret information, that you know everything, but you really don't, and you don't have as good a feel for things.
But you have access to the president.
Exactly.
Which is why they can be dangerous and bad things can happen.
Yeah, and when breakdowns happen and when the staff fills the void with their own ideas, a lot of decisions that I think were very misguided. I talk about Iran-Contra, but there are dozens other, right? Whether it's Michael Forrestal pushing for a coup in Vietnam in 1963, whether it's the Reagan administration pushing deeper into Lebanon's civil war, which led to the bombing of the Beirut airport, which killed 241 Marines in 1983, whether it's the surge, which was a courageous decision, but probably missed some strategic warnings along the way, to some of the decisions in Afghanistan over the past 10, 15 years. So what you see is that the staff, because of breakdowns in Washington, has helped shape America's way of war to be less patient, less strategic, and I think more much less successful as a result.
The title of your book sort of captures this a little bit, the White House Warriors, which is a little bit like, the desk-bound bureaucratic soldiers type thing.
Exactly.
I mean, that was your intention, is it?
For sure. And the line actually came from George.
Slightly disdainful.
Yeah, well, I have a deep appreciation for anybody that serves in government.
Yeah.
I think that it is, you dedicate your life to this country, you're already doing something right. But I'm still willing to question what you do. The line is actually from George W. Bush, who called the staffers who helped him find the surge his personal band of warriors. Mm-hmm. That's what he called them. but they're not warriors. So they don't actually, as I always say, and it was a national security advisor, Connie Rice, who said, it's like changing remote policy with a remote control. Like you don't actually own the guns. You don't actually order the diplomats. You can't actually order anything to be done from the NSA.
And you're also not accountable in the same way that, say, a general in the field would be.
Or a confirmed Secretary of State who has to go and explain what's going on to Congress. So you're actually in a situation where the staff is largely unaccountable. And I think for those reasons and because of how they've helped shift American foreign policy against what I think a lot of people voted for. I mean, I go through in this, you know, the 2006 election was about the Iraq War. And Americans voted dramatically that we needed to basically end the Iraq War. They put Democrats hugely in control. That was the end of the, that was the Democrats' message. And on the back end comes the surge, right? And a deepening of the Iraq War. Next, you have Obama, who gives this massive speech in 2002 against dumb wars. And he comes into the presidency, immediately sort of doubles down on Afghanistan and launches Libya. And the staff's, it's central to both those. And then you have Donald Trump, who came, said Afghanistan was a bad idea, we need to get out of these things, and then sort of basically accepts Obama's policy in Afghanistan of keeping troops there. And the one thing that explains all of those variances with the popular vote is the NSC staff and the advocacy for ideas.
So this bothers you. What do you want to have happen? How do you fix this?
Yeah, it bothers me because I sort of talk in the book, and I sort of thought about it a long time. I mean, and I do appreciate the civil servants, as I said, but I think as a result of sort of abdication by this sort of more sclerotic parts of government and presidential asks and sort of the ambitions of the staffers, the staff's become the most powerful entity in Washington today on national security. And what's problematic about that is at a time where Americans distrust Washington and distrust government, you have and sort of worry about a deep state and whether there's an, I don't think there's an official deep state in Washington because I don't think that there's too many people fighting in Washington to, for them to be organized into a deep state. But what I argue in the book is there's a lot of risks that the national security that to get discussed in the Situation Room and get discussed by the national security staff, but there's no bigger risk than the threat to America's way of life and the representative government, right? And if the NSC staff doesn't open itself up and sort of show what it does a little bit more and more people are going to lose trust in government and believe in this deep state stuff, which is deeply problematic and worrying. And that shouldn't be how our government works. It shouldn't be where people out there, my mom and dad and relatives and people I teach at Penn and elsewhere, worry that their government isn't listening to them. Because that's a bigger threat to America's security and America's future and America's way of life than anything that's happening in Iran, frankly.
So you did talk to H.R. McMaster. What does he think about his time with Donald Trump? What does he tell you about Donald Trump, working for Donald Trump?
I think that what he I talked to him for a long time and enjoyed the conversation. I learned a lot. I mean, I think my impression of it was that he did his best to try to bring some regular order to a very chaotic White House, right? When he walked in, the national security advisor resigned and later pled guilty. There was a lot of palace intrigue. There was a lot of forces going on. And my hunch is he basically said, we're going to block all that out. We're going to try to change some of the bad things, like get Bannon off there. We're going to try and get some normal rhythm here. And we're going to try and put some strategies in place. Mm-hmm. And I think he feels proud of the strategies and the decisions they made in the national security strategy that ended in 2017 was lauded by a lot of people who actually don't like Donald Trump. Like it was considered to be a pretty sound document. But I don't think it was an easy place to work. And I don't think it's an easy place to work today.
How would General Flynn have worked out if he would have stayed as national security advisor?
It's a very good question. And I think that you wouldn't have, obviously, this daylight between Flynn and the president, which I think would have been good for the president's interest. I think that, generally speaking, things get a little unwieldy when the national security advisor doesn't agree with the president on a regular basis. But I think Flynn was going to have a hard time with government because so many people didn't like his style when they were in government with him. I mean, a lot of people...
The knives were out, speaking of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. I mean, my hunch is that the Defense Department wasn't going to be easy on him. And I think the fireworks between him and McMattis might have been something to watch, not in a good way. But I think that my hunch is that he would have been able to serve the president's policy interests better. But I think the process would have broken down.
You can never tell, though. I mean, a lot of those people that came in that were close to the president are no longer there. Yep. So who knows how it would have been. Yep. But you're obviously right. I mean, the history that he would have brought and all of the enemies that he would have brought along. And I still can't quite figure out how that all played out. I think we're still waiting for some of the shoes to drop.
For sure. I mean, sadly, I think that people are going to be writing about this administration for the rest of our lives, trying to understand this moment, and trying to, I think, repair the damage that's done in the process, both in terms of government, in terms of our foreign policy. And so trying to understand it is important. And I think there's a lot of hunger out there for people to try and understand Washington, try and understand the world. And I hope I could add a little piece to it to explain one piece.
Yeah, the book is fascinating. White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War, just released this month. John Ganz, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.